Encore with Claire O'Brien, arts and entertainment for the Midlands. With the Dean Crow Theatre and Arts Centre Athlone, imagine the possibilities. DeanCrowTheatre.com.
The Proclaimers come to Portlaoise, sort of. Cinema in the Midlands in the 70s. A life of depression and struggle rescued by poetry and creative writing. And a bard on the road selling poems to people in their own marketplace. You're welcome to Midlands 103's dedicated arts show. I'm Claire O'Brien and every Thursday night I bring you the best of what is happening in the arts in Laois, Offaly and Westmeath. Encore at midlands103.com is the email address. I would love to hear from you. And 083 3010 103 is powered by the home of Offaly's top-selling car brand, Lamb Brothers Toyota, on the Arden Road in Tullamore. You can drop me a text this evening. Tonight on the show, the Proclaimers, as I said, are coming to Portlaoise, but that is a slight exaggeration because Portlaoise Musical Society are bringing the musical Sunshine on Leith to the stage for the very first ever amateur performance in the country. JJ Tynan will be on a little bit later on to tell us about the musical itself, which features the music of the Proclaimers, but tells a very different story. New work from a poet who has struggled with his mental health. Enda Spellman's memoir, A Thorny Bed of Roses, will be launched this Saturday in Ballinasloe. And Enda has been telling me about how poetry almost literally saved his life when he really struggled with very dark times. And a poet of long standing is Arthur Broomfield, who was with us on Encore, I think it's over a year ago now, when his most recent poetry collection was published. But poetry, as you can imagine, is not the biggest selling art form. But Arthur has gone old style bard and has visited towns across the Midlands to sell, wait for it, more than 2,500 copies of his books. We're going to be talking to Arthur a little later on about the thrill of the poet meeting the reader in person. But you might remember last week on the programme we gave you the first half of an interview with Midlands historian Ger Dooley, and he was telling us about the history of cinema in Laois and Offaly around Port Arlington and the various different counties, and he had taken us right up all the beginning from the Stella and from Eamon de Valera right up to the 1960s, where cinemas closed down and reopened but very often under different names. So here he takes on the story continuing on from the 1970s, and this is historian Ger Dooley.
Once you get into the 1970s, say a cinema might close, as they had done in the previous decade, but the difference this time was they weren't reopening.
Okay.
Rat Bounty closed, the Electric itself closed, and lots of different cinemas would have closed and not reopened at all. And you had the situation, indeed, in 1985, I think it was, when the Coliseum, which would have been Portlaoise's only cinema then, indeed, Laois's only cinema for a time then, it was destroyed by fire, and when that happened, there was no cinema whatsoever in Laois. So that didn't last for very long, and the Coliseum opened up, renovated as a duoplex, and kept going for another 15 years or so. Indeed, that was the first cinema I had ever gone to, the duoplex of the Coliseum I went to see. I had Lion King with Mother back
wow.
in early 90s, fond memories. But yeah, no, the idea that there's only one cinema in Laois would seem an anathema to people, you know, who may be in their 50s or 60s, sorry,
yeah.
or, you know, older, 70s or
yeah.
80s now.
I should also mention that in Mount Melick there is the Balcony Cinema, because that upstairs space has been repurposed to a small extent, and
yeah.
the old equipment is used to show films in there still, and they meet one night a week. I think it's every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. They show a different movie, and there's a whole different feel about it. It's very community orientated, run by a community to show a film, have a cup of tea, kind of enjoy the
yeah.
evening
well,
out, which is more like what it might have been a long, long time ago.
Oh, absolutely. And you mentioned Mount Melick there. Mount Melick has a special place in kind of the history of cinema in Laois. Not only was the second cinema opened in the CYMS Hall in Mount Melick, but in the 1951, April 1951 to be specific, the cinema moved to a new purpose-built place, and it was opened by President Sean T. O'Kelly. It was built for at a cost of £22,000. They really upped the game, and that was the real premier cinema in the Midlands, in Montmellick for a time. So yeah, it's great to hear that that community effort is keeping that legacy alive in the town.
I should also mention to you that, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but you might be as a Laois man, that when the church in Montmellick was being restored, there was significant work happening there, that Mass actually happened in the cinema. And Sheila Coyle Dunn, who is a writer and a former teacher at Montmellick, wrote a really nice piece about Mass in the cinema. Because I know, which is not what you'd expect, but that's what happened there as well. We mentioned Port Arlington at the top of the programme. The Savoy in Port Arlington has a particular history.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The Savoy would have been, you know, one of the earlier kind of cinemas to open up. But of course, you know, it kind of fell by the wayside in the 90s, along with a lot of other cinemas, but not before it held, you know, a great place in cinematic history for Laois. A lot of the film Into the West was filmed in the area. And of course, that famous scene with the white horse that was filmed in the Savoy, and it's wonderful to hear that, you know, plans are well afoot to bring back the legacy of cinema in Port Arlington as well.
Can I ask, I don't know if it's a fair question to ask somebody who is a historian and whose job is looking back ways, but also I know in your role as a programme manager at the College of Business and UCD, you have an ability to look forward as well and plan ahead. What do you think is the future for cinema in Laois and in general?
I think that, you know, I did research on this, it's about 2 years ago now, it feels like the other day, but we've been during the pandemic, and it was at the time when all cinemas were closed during lockdown. And kind of the thrust of my piece was, you know, when things open back up, notwithstanding the likes of Netflix and Amazon Prime, we should all start going back to the cinema. But even only in the last 2 years, you've seen so much more streaming services come online. You've got Disney Plus, Apple TV, Paramount Plus was launched in Britain and Ireland only today, so that's an extra one. They're under great strain. They are, you know, I think the idea of a community-led initiative like you see in Port Arlington, Montmellick, that may be not quite the future of cinema, but one way to keep it alive in smaller areas. I think the audience in Port Laois is going to, you know, it's going to feel a strain, you know, staffing constraints and stuff like that. But the whole world of cinema, there's always going to be a place for cinema. There's always going to be a place for a cinema, kind of with a small c, if you understand me. There's no replicating the likes of seeing modern blockbusters, for instance, in, you know, your no matter how big your TV screen is in your sitting room, you know, you got to feel that experience, the communal experience of being in a cinema, just as your parents would have done their parents before them and their parents before them. You know, it's a legacy that spans throughout the 20th century. And whether it's people going to see stuff in the Electric when it opened in 1914, seeing Charlie Chaplin, or moving forward to seeing Casablanca when it was eventually released by the censor in 1946, or hearing the booming soundtrack from John Williams from Star Wars in the 70s, you know, that's a communal legacy that, you know, it would be so sad to see that go. So, look, is it going to be easy for cinemas in the next 10, 15 years? No, it probably is not, but they face challenges before, and I think they're well able to rise to it, and it's great that there's community initiatives to keep it alive and going.
It's a great look into the past and a look ahead to the future from historian Ger Dooley. And that was Sunshine on Leith from Tea in the Park. And that was, of course, the Proclaimers. And of course, you have to hear it live. Well, it is musical theatre time again. And how great is it to be able to say that absolutely all the doors are open? We're so lucky in the Midlands to have such great musical societies. And Port Laois are back with a bang for 2022 with Sunshine on Leith. Not content with just a national premiere of the show, they are the first musical society to have an Irish Sign Language performance. My colleague Chloe Farrell has been talking to the club's PRO, and that is JJ Tynan, about why they chose this particular show for this year.
We decided to go with Sunshine on Leith because we've never been afraid really of taking chances when it comes to new shows. Since we started in 1999, we've never on the same show twice. So yeah, just we like to do something different, and with this show we're bringing a premiere to Ireland. So it's the first time Sunshine on Leith has ever been done in the Republic of Ireland. It has been done in Belfast, so it's a first for us, so we're really excited about that.
Can you tell me a bit about the story of the show?
The story of the show, it's a fairly modern show. It's based in 2014, and it's basically the show is based around the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. So the two of our main leads in the show, Dave and Ali, are basically coming back from Afghanistan and coming back to their hometown of Leith, just outside Edinburgh, and all the trials and tribulations that goes around that. So dealing with PTSD, dealing with breakups, coming home to the family. So like I say, it's a really modern show, and all set around the backdrop of the music of the Proclaimers.
Can you tell me a bit about who's in the key roles for the show?
Some of the guys who has been with us for a few years, Shane Kelly was on stage with us for Ragtime and for Titanic. He plays the role of Davy. And we have Owen Fingleton, who's no stranger to Portlaoise, and he takes on the role of Ali. And we've got a few newcomers in Andrew Doherty, who's taken on the role of Rab Henshaw. Hilary Tracy is going to take on the role of his wife, Jean. And we also have Aisling Rowan taking on the role of Vaughan. And we have Sarah Try and also Aoife Dygan. So that there's seven main principals, and then we have all the Portlaoise musical crew filling in the rest of the ensemble and chorus.
For one of your shows, you have an Irish Sign Language interpreter. How did the idea come around for that?
The idea was brought forward by our secretary, Hilary Tracy. She's actually playing the role of Jean in the show. She's playing one of the main leads. She brought about the idea and brought it to committee, and committee backed her from start to finish. It's the first time that an amateur production, that to the best of our knowledge, has ever been signed by an ISL. So it's really exciting. Mary Guest is the interpreter who's going to be with us on Monday the 21st. So it's just opening up theatre to people who normally wouldn't have an opportunity to take in, you know, the joys of live musical theatre. So we're really, really excited about that. It's our first time back on stage since 2019, when we finished with Ragtime. So we're just about 3 years off the stage. So, I mean, the cast and society are absolutely chomping at the bit to get back on stage and bring Portlaoise, you know, the best that we can, as we do every year. So we're really excited about that. So just for people to contact the box office at Dunamace, book their tickets, and hopefully when we open on Saturday the 19th, we'll have full houses for the week between there and the 25th.
Was it difficult getting back into the routine of being on stage after having the gap for 3 years?
There was obviously at the start, there was a little bit of anxiety, but I think that was soon forgotten. Everyone was really glad to put COVID behind them and get back into the rehearsal space. And, you know, there's such like giddiness and excitement when all the society members came back together for the first time, you know. So that was really exciting. It's been a great experience. I mean, we're back rehearsing more or less since the last weekend in August. It's not something that's easy put together, but for the main part, it's a very enjoyable experience. We'd also like to say a huge thank you to all our sponsors. There is huge generosity towards us, and we're very, very lucky with all the sponsors who are on board to bring this show to light. Like, I mean, the cast, like, it's a non-profit community group. Like, all money goes exactly into bringing a production.
Yeah, and we all know, don't we, how expensive it is to put a musical on the stage. Is one of those issues that has come up over and over and over again with our musical societies across the Midlands, whether it's in Offaly or in Tullamore, Offaly or in Westmeath, or indeed in County Leash, that hugely expensive to put on. I will let you know that, of course, the Sunshine on Leith is playing at the Dunamace Theatre in Portlaoise from Saturday the 19th to Saturday the 26th, and you can get tickets at dunamace.ie or at the box office. And that sign language version of the performance is going to happen at on Monday the 21st of November, which will be really, really interesting. As I say, it's the first time that has ever happened. And Irish Sign Language interpreter Mary Guest will accompany the show to ensure that everybody can experience the magic of the production in all of its glory. It's also, actually, I should mention that all of the seats for the ISL assisted performance are a little bit cheaper as well. So it's even more accessible to a wider audience. And Mary is from Moneygall, but is based now in Tullamore. Still to come on the programme, wandering man of words, Arthur Broomfield will be talking to us about how he went from around the towns in the Midlands selling his poetry books to people who are out and about at various different markets. Before that, it has taken Enda Spellman more than 20 years to write his memoir. It is published and by V Mayon Shaw Publications, who are based in Athlone, and indeed they came in contact with Enda through his work on the community collective there in Athlone, Poetry in the Park. And the autobiography, the memoir, contains some poetry as well indeed. Enda is a man of plain language and plain words, and I chatted to him recently, and when we did, the first thing he did was introduce himself in the most lovely way.
Hello, my name is Enda Spellman. I've suffered depression most of my life. Well, nearly 40 years now at the moment. Well, 38. Since I was 21. I've had many ups and downs. And I'm good now at the moment. I'm on medication all the time. I had two books of poetry out back the years. A little bit of this and a little bit of that. And Darkness and Light. Pat Inglesby launched it for me in Wisconsin. That is 2 years back, over 20 years ago. And well, it went well, sold fairly well locally. I went round from town to town with a bag in my back, hitching from town to town with a bag in my back, leaving in books, shops. Uh-huh. Not one shop refused me.
Well,
it went down very well with a lot of people, and said it was a good book. The poetry was.
Yeah.
Now I have started writing my life story, my autobiography, and it's been working in, I've been working on it for a good few years now at the moment, but thanks be to God, it finally has come to fruition.
Yeah.
I'm having a launch on the 19th of November in the library here in Ballinasloe, where I live now at the moment.
Okay. And the book is called A Thorny Bed of Roses.
Thorny Bed of Roses.
And that gives me the impression, Enda, that there's...
The reason for the name of the book is, I see the crown of thorns, our Lord, around his head, and the roses remind me of heaven, and I just see myself as taking one thorn out of our Lord's crown of thorns. And when I get to heaven, hopefully, it'll turn to roses.
Okay. So tell me about the thorniness in the life of Enda Spellman.
Depression down the years and what I went through with it in the dark days and all that. My first depression was in Dublin. I was down as bad when I was 21. 2 weeks afterwards, my life went head over heel. I ended up in a psychiatric hospital. I had a poor view of them myself before that. I thought it's a place I'd never be going into, and the stigma attached to them and all the rest. But I got out of the hospital after about 3 months. I wasn't fully right. Went back to work, and within a month or 3 weeks, I was given the sack from the job because I couldn't cope. I wasn't able to get up in the morning to go to work. I did a lot of mistakes at work, and that was a devastating part of my life. And numerous admissions to psychiatric hospitals afterwards. A lot of them are due to the fact that I didn't take my prescription, my tablets, like medication, because of the side effects. But thanks be to God now, for a good many years I'm in good health. And I'm out living in a house of my own now at the moment.
It sounds like an extraordinary life of tough
some
times.
Journey, no, I tell you, my life, it was some journey. depression is a thing that's very hard to put your finger on when you're trying to explain to people. But it debilitates you as if you were a cripple. If you weren't able to walk, you'd have a reason for it. But depression is a thing that cannot be described until you go through it yourself. I was restless, hearing voices, terrible, terrible things. Not a black mare to me, that's what it says. I've been some severe downs, and I've gone elated as well. But thanks be to God, my mood is taken now with the medication I'm on, and I will be on it for the rest of my life, and I won't stop taking it ever again.
And do you think, Enda, is the attitude to depression and mental illness different now?
It's improved a bit, but you see, when I was in Dublin, in Vincent's and Fairview, in the psychiatric hospital there, I had colleagues at work trying to come in to see me. I didn't tell them. I didn't tell anyone, only my family at home and was coming. Because I don't know if going through the depression, but the stigma of it, that's the early 80s. It was a lot worse than it is today. But still, there's a lot of it out there.
And what do you think will it take to change that, Enda?
Education. I know education for young kids going to school. I got bullied in school as well, and that's in my book as well, like, you know. The thing I like to talk to kids about myself, like, going to school to talk to them, if I got the chance, like, you know, about the bullying and about depression. Because there's so many people suffer from depression today that they aren't getting the right care for it. Because of the stigma of psychiatric hospitals, people don't like going in there. And it's out of mind, outside of our mind, that a lot of people used to make one time, back to years.
And can you describe for me, if you were to imagine, if you were to paint a picture for me of when you became aware of the fact that you were in the psychiatric hospital in Dublin, what did you see around you? What did it look like?
I didn't actually know where I was. I was there overhead. I hadn't a clue where I was. And I actually got, after going into the hospital, I got a vitamin injection, which was notoriously painful. That's one of the first things I remember, and a few tablets. And I went to sleep, and that was on a Monday. I went to sleep. I slept for 3 days. I remember waking up, and my sister was beside me, sitting beside me in the hospital. And she said, "What is today?" She said to me. I just had to wake up at this thing. She said, it's Monday, I said to her. It's Monday or Tuesday. She said, "It's Thursday, you're after sleeping for 72 hours. I was totally jaded. I was working long hours, not sleeping well. Something had to give, because my mental had to give.
And here we are now, 40 years on. From that event,
yeah,
38 years on.
The difference.
What were the positives there, and what supported you along the way in that 38 years?
Well, I started writing poetry about depression. I had a lot of stuff in my head. When I started writing the poetry, someone said to me one time, I was finding it hard to sleep, he said, "Write down something on a piece of paper about everything that went wrong during your day and read through it 10 times and tear it up." I started putting it in poetic form. That's how my poetry started. It started after my depression. I never wrote poetry before that. And in 1996, I brought out them books, A Little Bit of This, A Little Bit of That, Darkness and Light.
And that is Enda Spellman talking about his poetry, his new book, his memoir, that tells a bit more about that story of what has been a very, very tough life. And as he says himself, it's written in very plain language, in his own words, will be launched this Saturday at the library in Ballinasnow, and that is Enda Spellman. And the book, as I say, is published by Vime on Shaw Publishers, who are based in Athlone as well. And you're very welcome back to the programme. You might remember last week when I was talking to you, I mentioned the Leaves Festival of Literature, of Words and Music, that was happening in County Laois last weekend, and all the wonderful events that they had, and the one county, one book, which was the phenomenal Small Things Like These, and all the great things that happened across the county. Well, one of the things that happened was that I was interviewing in Port Laois Library with the lovely Aoife Moore, the librarian there. I was speaking to Ronan Heshen, who is the author of Panenka, and also of what is a great book, Leonard and Hungry Paul. And while I was there, I got chatting to somebody who is well known to you on the programme, who is Arthur Broomfield. And Arthur said to me, Arthur, you're very welcome to the programme. I don't know
Thank
if you remember.
Very much, Claire.
You're
Thank
very
you.
Welcome. You said to me before you were leaving, you said, you know, I've sold 2,600 copies of Ireland Calling. Let me tell you all about it. And you were on your way out the door. Tell me about how you have managed to sell 2,700 copies of Ireland Calling, because poetry is not generally in the top of the bestsellers, but you have found a unique way of getting poems into pockets.
Yes. Well, we launched Ireland Calling almost two years ago in the library in Port Laois. Mm. And the way and we sold a good few that night, of course. But then what I do is, which is unique to poets, I just go on from town to town, calling to all the businesses, offices, hairdressers, antique shops, solicitors, and so on, along the street, and ask them to support the book, and if they're interested, they buy it, and so on. So I do that, and I go out 3 days a week, and I sell quite a lot of books. I might sell 30 books a day at least, and I'd average around 90 a week in sales. But I suppose the most interesting part of it is the people I meet, which is absolutely lovely. And, you know, I have to say this, and without any plum mousing, Irish people are genuinely lovely. And, you know, I meet some really, really interesting people. Some people who are totally unexpectedly really interested in poetry and philosophy. And I might spend too much time talking to them rather than getting on about my business. But,
tell us about that. Tell us about those kinds of chats. Who are the kinds of people that you meet, and what are the kinds of conversations you're having with them?
Yeah, well, you know, you'd have all kinds of conversations. Sometimes I just go in and say, I'm Arthur Broomfield, I write poetry, this is my book, would you like to buy it? You know, because people in business, you know, they don't want to be hanging around talking to somebody, you know.
they don't need the schmooze or the soft sell.
Not at all. No. And they're going to buy it or not. And it's amazing. The market for poetry out there is unbelievable. There are so many people interested in it. They might buy it for a daughter or a son going to school, or for a parent, because Ireland Calling is set in an Ireland of a generation back, you know, an Ireland that is lost. And it's very nostalgic, well, would appear to be nostalgic anyway, and brings back memories to the older people who love it, and plenty of people who buy it for their parent or uncle or aunt. And I also find the various people I go to, surprisingly, you can go into some a kind of a shop that's not modern, let's put it that way, and there could be a guy there, and he would be maybe not doing much business at all. You'd wonder why he's there. But he'd be just so interested, and you could have a very long conversation about poetry, about Yeats or Gavin or Wordsworth. Yeats and Gavin would crop up
all the time, I suppose. Yeah.
They're the really popular ones. I tell you who's very good as well. Ladies hairdressers. There's a lady in Ferns in County Wexford. It is in Wexford. And I've called her now three times, and she wants the book every time. But the first time I called, she said, well, you have to read a poem for me. So I read the book. So entertained herself and three or four ladies who were in the shop.
Haikus at the hairdressers.
Yeah, haikus at the hairdressers. And she was really pleased with it. She was lovely. So she bought it. Now, every time I go back, she asked me to read another poem. So there you are.
Tell me, I mean, what's it like? And how did you strike upon this idea? I know I met you not long after Ireland's Calling was published at the farmer's market in Portlaoise. You were there one morning and we didn't stay long to chat because you were busy selling books of poetry. But did it start at the market and then you worked your way up the street, so to speak? Or what made you decide you were going to knock on doors?
It started in 1994 when I wrote a book, a novel called When the Dust Settles.
Did it start that long ago?
Yes.
Really?
So, and I got far too many of those printed. I self-published it. Well, International University Press, which is me. So I said, well, I have to ship these books. So I went and took off with them all around Ireland, and that's how I started. And I sold about 4,000 of those that way. It was quite a controversial book, actually. And I still meet people who bought it. And they say, oh, I bought your book. And, you know, they kind of liked it because, well, it was anti-establishment, really, that book, you know. So there's plenty of people out there who have mixed views about the establishment, let's put it that way, who've been in some conflict or other with them sometimes. So I hate to say this, I'm not being immodest, but I am a little bit of a folk hero due to that book. And I have to say this about it. I admit this. It was terribly badly produced.
Was it?
There was about 10 typos on each page. It was dreadful. But I said that to a few people. Ah, no, we didn't mind that at all. So the story was good. We've written the story.
So that's
what started me. And then when I wrote my first full poetry collection, Cold Copy at Emo Court. I took off with that. And I always start in Portlaoise, my hometown. And they're great. I must say, Portlaoise people are great. I'd hardly get a refusal in it.
Yeah. Did you get into the car and you go further afield, as far as Ferns?
Oh, I do, yeah. All over Ireland. Back north. I don't go up north. I mean, I don't go to the Naoiseach-Gundé. But I would go to Donegal. And although I haven't been to Donegal yet with Ireland Calling, or Sligo. So, but I don't intend going now up there until the days get longer.
Still, tell me what is that like to go knocking on people's doors and the doors of business people?
Well, I don't knock on doors. I walk into the businesses.
Okay.
Because door-to-door selling just doesn't work. You might sell one for every 10.
Yeah.
Whereas in the businesses, business people are very good and. You know, and for all different reasons, they might have a genuine love of poetry, and don't underestimate that. There is a great love for poetry out there among the people, that I think the literary establishment doesn't tap into at all.
Yeah,
they put them in bookshops, and most of those people wouldn't go into a bookshop to buy a book. But when you call them, say, "Oh, I love poetry, and I love such a poem," and Kavanagh is so popular. Patrick Kavanagh is so popular.
Yeah. Everybody remembers the Stony Grey Soil and the Great Hunger and the Memories of My Father.
Well, that's right, yeah. Yeah, they love Kavanagh and they love Yeats. They'll always quote The Lake Isle of Village Free.
Of course.
And Wordsworth, of course. I wandered lonely as a cloud and so on.
See, it's all the poems that people learned by heart, isn't it, Arthur? Yeah. The ones we learned by heart in school.
Well, yeah, but you know, in these times when the world is in such distress and disorder, a lot of people will quote Things Fall Apart, The Centre Cannot Hold. From that great poem.
It's Yeats, isn't it? Surely the Second Coming is at hand.
The Second Coming. It ends up with the two lines, and what rough beast, it's our come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born.
It's awful, isn't it?
Ominous, you know.
Yeah,
but
it is.
Yeah.
And this, I'm guessing that the 2 years once COVID got out of the way have been really enjoyable for you then in traipsing around the country and chatting to people and selling the books.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love meeting the people, and you know, and they're genuinely good and appreciative. They kind of say, "Aren't you great now? What you're at, and support you anyway." Yeah. And I have good old chats with some of them. Now you meet an advent that says, well, of course, there'll be plenty that won't buy it.
Yeah.
For a multitude of reasons, you don't know why. Mm. But, you know, you just thank them and smile and go, you know. Because, well, you never know what's going through, what troubles people have or what torments or worries they have, you know.
Yeah, and finally, we're, you know, people are in tough times. I am wondering, well, you know, when you include the cost of, you know, of diesel, you probably have a cup of coffee when you're out. You're losing the time that you could be doing on something else. Do you make a few quid out of it at all?
I do, yeah, I do. I make enough to get by. I do. To be honest about that, and it's one of the attractions. It's one of the reasons I go out. I don't think I'd go out if I wasn't making a good out.
Okay.
I won't be making millions or anything. I won't be, unless I win the Nobel, you know. You never know.
Well, you stay going. And do the visits then inspire any poetry in themselves? Do you find yourself, I must sit down and write a bit about that now. I have a line from that.
Yeah, you'd imagine it should, but it doesn't. No, it just the poetry comes from God knows where, you know.
But not from your trails around the country.
Well, not directly, anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, but one never knows, you know, what's going on in the unconscious.
Well, you see now that you're going to have your hibernation of the short days of the winter and the long evenings. Who knows what will make its way back up to the top of your consciousness. Arthur, thanks a million for chatting to us on the programme tonight. It's always lovely to talk to you, and continued good luck with Ireland Calling, and we'll be back out in the new year selling away again. Thanks so much for talking to us. That is poet Arthur Broomfield there. And that is it from me for Encore for this evening. The great Joe Cooney is in the building. I see his head passing by the window just now. Next week on the programme, some writing from somebody who's mostly associated with art. We'll also be talking to Hubert Murray about some brand new music. Till then, take care of yourself. Good night.